from the minute I walked on the stage, something struck me, electricity, a bell rang, and the self-imposed fog that I had been living in just cleared, and I could hear myself, and I was alive. For this moment, for this second, I was free and weightless. I spent my life chasing the fireflies on the edges of my eyes.
That was Sally Field, the double Oscar-winning actress. And the fog she was escaping descended following sexual abuse by her stepfather, Jocko Mahoney, when she was a child. She lost herself in acting. Her career began as a teenager, playing the all-American lead in Gidget. She went on to star in The Flying Nun and then made her first film, The Way West, with Kirk Douglas in 1967. A host of television movies followed before she joined her then-boyfriend Burt Reynolds in the box office hit Smokey and the Bandit. Reynolds was another controlling man in her life, as was the film director Bob Rafelson, whom she was forced to kiss before being cast by him in Stay Hungry. She won her first Oscar for the title role of Norma Rae in 1980, and she's appeared in, amongst others, Steel Magnolias, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Forrest Gump, winning another Best Actress Academy Award for Places in the Heart in 1985. She was given an Outstanding Lead Actress Emmy for her television show Brothers and Sisters, and most recently was nominated for Best Actress in Lincoln in 2012. She's now written a memoir, In Pieces. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I sat down with her on The Big Interview. Sally, we're here in London, and you've been here promoting your book, which is an extraordinary book. It's about this amazing life, full of experience, but also trauma to a degree. A wonderfully brave book, but it also charts your acting career, and I wondered if you'd always known that you were going to act.
Well, by the time, you know, you're ever thinking about what are you going to be when you grow up kind of thought, I think it was always an actor. I can't remember ever having the thought of, gee, I wanted to be a nurse or a fireman or a... I think being an actor was always the top of the list. But I have to honestly say that somewhere lurking, not far behind, but quickly got, you know, diminished till it was no longer visible, was the thought that I wanted to be a writer.
Which, of course, you've now achieved.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you remember the first time you performed?
Yes, I do. Very well. Very well, clearly. I was 12 years old, and I was lucky enough to have a theater arts department at my public junior high school or middle school or whatever you call it. It was the seventh grade. And it wasn't a stage, even. It was just a classroom that all the chairs and desks were sort of pushed to the side, and we were using the front of the class, and I did a scene from Born Yesterday, played the Billie Holiday character, the brassy bombshell, which I'm completely wrong for, even in the best of gay scenarios, but I remember it clearly, clearly.
And the kind of response you got from it?
You know, I don't remember the response I got from the teacher or the class. I remember the response from me. I remember it so clearly that from the minute I walked on what was supposed to be the stage, something struck me, a little zats of electricity, a bell rang, and the self-imposed fog that I had been living in just cleared, and I could hear myself, and I was alive. It didn't matter what anyone thought of me or what they wanted of me. For this moment, for this second, because it didn't last long, I was free and weightless. And then, of course, it went away, and then I didn't know what to put my hands and any of that sort of stuff. But that exquisite feeling of being alive is what has driven me my entire life. And I would say, long ago, before I even thought of writing this, I would always say that I spent my life chasing the fireflies on the edges of my eyes, because it kind of felt just electric. Something brightened and came alive.
And that fog that you described, that's something that would descend. It was a kind of way of protecting yourself from the abuse that you were getting from your stepfather, who himself was an actor to a degree. He was a stuntman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you found a way, really, to protect yourself by just bringing down your own fog bank.
Yes, the fog, the self-imposed fog, it was gradual, but it really became the way I lived my life by the time I was an adolescent. Certainly at 12, it was really beginning to be how I saw the world, very muted. There were no sharp edges or colors. And as a result, I couldn't really read a book or concentrate on schoolwork. I almost didn't graduate because I did so poorly, but I could memorize a poem. And I would memorize the longest poem I could find. In English class, they'd say, now you memorize a poem and recite it to the class. I could do that. I could memorize dialogue. I could go on stage and become, for that instant, alive. And then I would go back into this world that the feelings that were overwhelming me would just be tossed out into this mistiness. You know, I had a sense of them, but they weren't sharp and they weren't colorful. But that fog really didn't exist all the time in my childhood. It became more strongly defined as I started to reach adolescence, where my own feelings were coming alive. And adolescence is a complicated time under the best of cases. Since I had a threatening male in the house, it was very dangerous.
And a man who you really loved. I mean, he was a lovely stepfather to you some of the time.
Yes.
But a huge bully in other ways. And I don't just mean the abuse. I mean, all sorts of things, forcing you to just work out on monkey bars or swimming and things like that. You say in the book, in fact, that it was more about your failure than your success.
That's... Well, I don't know that it was, but there was a part of me that when I was about 10 or so, I started to pull part of me, not all of me, and I it's taken me so long to be able to recognize that part of me was simply fragmenting, you know, because I would feel so distinctly one thing aspect here, and then there would be another aspect someplace else trying to be heard. And some voice and some piece of me started to be suspect that his driving both my brother and myself to accomplish physical feats when we were outside in the backyard, physical feats that in a lot of ways were not, I wasn't capable of. His mockery wasn't about wanting me to achieve something. It was about wanting to see me fail. I sensed it. And whether that was true or not, I don't know. But as I look at it now, through my older eyes, as I started to look at it in my 70s, the 60s and 70s, I think he didn't even see it, but that was the case.
You go on to talk about the director you worked with, Bob Raffleson, and I found this so interesting, who basically used the casting couch, who forced you to kiss him. But you say of that it was just the 70s, that's what happened.
It was. Partially, I try never to come to a conclusion or put a definition to his behavior or even mine. I simply talk about the things that add up to me. And these moments, the several incidents in my life that imprinted on me and led me and informed me one way or the other throughout my life. This instance, certainly it was the 70s, certainly I didn't know that anyone had a choice. That's just the way things are. But more importantly, I think when I write about that episode, and one of the reasons I do write about it, is because I was so predisposed to fall into that, because it wasn't any different than what I had grown up with. And it felt familiar. People have a tendency to fall into what feels familiar, even if it's unproductive, only because it's familiar. I knew this behavior. I had spent my lifetime performing for an older man whose approval I needed. I knew what this was. I could do this. Ultimately, when I did get the job, it was only in looking at it now, it was only in forcing myself to write it down, did I recognize the cost to me. Because I didn't let myself feel it then. I felt something, but I didn't recognize what it was.
That conflation of love and fear, which we see again in your relationship with Burt Reynolds, which I know you've written about a lot in the book, you never blame him, but it's clear that it was a dysfunctional relationship.
Well, I think on both of our parts, the perfect match of flaws, I think. Again, I was predisposed to fall into this place, and I ask, even within the book, would he have acted differently if I could have acted differently? I think these are the questions I asked myself along the way in really trying to see what that very complicated, very confusing time was for me, even though it was only, really, we were only together like 3 years, and then off and on for maybe two more after that, but off and on, not even really consistently together. But it confused me. And the reason it confused me is because it fits so succinctly into the pattern that I have spent my life trying to get out of. And it is my task to try to unweave this survival mechanism that has led me many times and in a lot of cases kept me perhaps from moving in directions that might have been more successful, more rewarding.
There were some very positive men in your life too, though. Lee Strasberg, for instance, of the Actors Studio. Tell me about him.
Well, my dear friend, who became my dear friend, Madeline Sherwood, who played the Mother Superior on The Flying Nun, at the end of the first year when I was so terribly depressed, really dealing with all sorts of things that were finally bubbling up inside me, I folded up literally one day on the set. She didn't take me under her wing. She wasn't like that. She never coddled or babied or she didn't, you know, try to ooey-ooey you to anything. She simply one day stuffed a piece of paper in my hand and said, "It's near the studio. Meet me there on Tuesday after work. It's the Actor's Studio. Do you know of it?" And I felt very challenged and threatened by her. I wasn't sure she liked me. I certainly wasn't sure I liked her. But I said, "I'll be there." And she said, "I'll see you there." And she did. She met me there. And it was my beginning. It was the beginning of my work with Lee Strasberg that went on for years and years and years. A very important relationship in my life and what he taught me and gave to me. And Madeline stayed always in my life. Just a remarkable, colorful woman herself. What a life she had. And he was certainly a very powerful influence. And there were other men, important mentor, really supportive people.
Like Marty Ritt, for instance.
Like Marty Ritt, who directed Norma Rae. One of the great things about getting to do Norma Rae eventually was that Marty Ritt entered my life. And I hear his words in my head to this day. I talk to him sometimes, especially when I'm on a set and I'm confused. I talk to him. He's long since passed away, but I'm sure he hears me. Not only did I have the opportunity to get Marty Ritt in my life, which was so key, but having the opportunity to stand in Norma's shoes, just like when I had the opportunity before that to stand in Sybil's shoes, they so serendipitously joined me at the most important times of my life with pieces of me that were trying to submerge, that I had so deeply submerged. I couldn't contact them unless I were in a role like Sybil that made me reach in and contact these pieces of myself. And the same with Norma. So standing in her shoes, I could hear my voice. And that was huge at that moment.
Mm. The book reads very much like a love letter to your mother, who is a very strong character all of the way through it. And indeed, it was her death, really, that prompted you to start bringing all of this together.
Yes, it was. She died on my 65th birthday, and I thought I had done all the things that you should do. I'd had the conversations. We'd been together. Anything we thought we'd left undone, we tried to do. And yet when she was gone, I felt deeply, deeply disquieted. It wasn't grief. There was something missing. There was something that I needed to live with that was missing. Like there was a gangrenous limb on my body and I needed to find it quick. Otherwise, I would go down. So serendipitously, I was asked to write the keynote address for this phenomenal group called Women in Power at the Omega Institute in upstate New York. And I had been to these before. I knew what they were. They were the most remarkable women from all over the world. And I told my friend, "I can't give a keynote address. You can't ask me to give the keynote address. I have nothing to say." And she said, "Yes, you do." And that was the beginning. It was like click, 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 click. Yes, I do. And I wrote a very long speech, very raw and emotional and private, about an hour long, which is essentially kind of the last chapter of the book. And I stood up there in front of all of these wonderful women, 1,200 or something, and just shaking, quaking all over. And what I felt from them to me and from me to them struck me. I had to find a way to tell the story, not for them, but for me. And the only way I would do it is if I tried to, at the same time, learn a new craft, would be the craft of writing, because it was only in the craft of acting, in learning that craft, that I was forced to go in pieces and places of myself and learn things I didn't want to know and own parts of myself I didn't want to own. So I had to try to learn this craft, the craft of writing. Only then would I go into the boxes of memorabilia that I've drug around with me, into my own memories, into my own journals, and learn what I didn't want to see and what I have walked away from my entire life. And it was what was going to kill me unless I knew what it was.
Bringing all of those pieces together in this book and really finding your mother, saying what you needed to say to your mother, is what it was all about.
Yes. Ultimately, the last part of the book is about the culmination of that. It's also not an autobiography, as you know, it's a memoir, and I had to learn very clearly the difference that I know you know of the genre. It's very different than an autobiography. It's a specific part of my life, a specific thread of my life, even though it's many threads actually woven together, rather than just chronologically this happened and this happened and then I did this and that. There's many parts of my career and my work that aren't in it because they aren't a part of this one story that I'm telling. At the end of the book, because I had to reach out and find a really fine therapist, and thank God that I did, a therapist, Dr. Daniel Siegel, and my mother was literally passing away, really fighting tooth and nail breast cancer. And I felt like I was dying, and I needed help. At the same time, the Lincoln film was sort of coming to a head. Whereas I had first been asked to do it, I knew eventually, or I'd always said to myself that I probably wasn't going to do it, that it just wasn't going to be mine. Not that I wasn't right for it, but that it just wasn't going to be mine. Some voice kept saying, walk away. You don't have the strength to lose this battle, and you'll lose this battle. So some part of me over the years had risen slowly, insidiously, to quiet me, and I had listened, except I began to work with Dan. And how oddly life works, it's that each one of those ingredients fit together to be about one thing, and that was my mother. It was all about one thing, and that I had to talk to her. The voice that told me to quiet, whether I was going to fight for Lincoln or not, the anxiety I was feeling that I was dying to, all of it was about this one thing. And even when I had that conversation, which I did with her, and she behaved, I think, heroically, even after that, when she was gone, something was wrong. I couldn't see what I was supposed to see. I had huge chunks missing from the picture. So I had to go into all those boxes. I had to start at the very beginning. I had to line it all up in front of me and see if I could put all the pieces together and see what it was that I was missing. It took me 7 years, and ultimately I did. Actually, at the very end, and no one had read it, and for 7 years no one read anything. And towards the end, I was doing a play on Broadway last year, the beginning of last year. This was when the book was just getting to a point where it was almost finished, and I would go, after the Sunday matinee, I would go to my son's Brooklyn apartment, who was finishing his master's degree at Columbia, and I would sit on the floor with his rescue dog and Sam, and I would read things to Sam, my son, and he was the only one I was talking to because I couldn't figure out why I had done all of this. I was reading the last things, and I would say to Sam, what have I learned? How can't in this thing? I just have to put it back in the box with the memorabilia because I have no conclusion. Why did I do all of this? What have I learned? How have I changed anything? And it was Sam, my son, he wasn't even 30 then, he was 29, said, "Mom, don't you see how different you are now? How differently you see yourself than you did 7 years ago?" And I went, "Oh my gosh." And he was right. And slowly it dawned on me what the end of it was, and he was right. That before that, I had never been able to actually own, if that's the word, to embrace my own history, my own accomplishments, my own successes. I couldn't ever feel them, and I couldn't see myself as being successful. Forget the business, as a human. And I sat back and realized, because I had done all of this and I'd seen what I'd seen, pieces that I didn't want to know of myself, admitting places that I didn't ever want to admit to or look at, I realized what I had accomplished in my life so far, and that I had done it on my own two feet. And it was a feeling that I had never been able to feel before.
And in the book, I mean, you also say that you found it easy to write about shame, mm-hmm. and not celebrate your achievements.
It felt easier to somehow write not about all of the humiliating areas of my life, and certainly some of the trauma that I write about were, you know, really not easy to write about, but emotional beyond belief. But I wondered if that was my identity. I wondered if I had used, even inside my head, even the stories that I knew but didn't talk about, if somehow I held that as a red badge of courage, that I saw myself as, you see, you were kind of a helpless victim. That disallowed me, and it kept me from seeing the parts that I didn't like to see, the parts that weren't a helpless victim, the parts that participated in the game of hurting. I needed, if I was going to look at the parts that were traumatic when I was a child and I was a helpless victim, then I had to also look how I then participated in the destruction game. It was part of it. I couldn't have half and not the other half. And it was an important piece to say, yeah, well, there you go. There you have it.
But it has given us, the world, this wonderful performer, too. You were talking about being on Broadway. I think that was the Glass Menagerie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're returning to the stage, and you're returning to it here in London.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm very excited about that. This sort of came about, this offer came to me, just as I was beginning the end of this, the copy edit. I mean, literally, we were at the tail end of trying to pull all the strings together and tie them up in a big bow. First of all, I've always wanted to play the West End beat, and the old Vic has always seemed terribly romantic to me. It's Arthur Miller, it's All My Sons, which I've always thought was a powerful, powerful play. I thought, wow, this works out perfectly, because to be able to transition and let this baby go and walk away from her, which will be hard for me to do, go back into my world of acting. And it's probably the only thing other than my kids that could really totally draw me back out. So I'm really looking forward to it. Jeremy is a wonderful director. I really like his work. And I'll be here, which I'm very excited about. And it'll be cold and wintry. We've already talked about the fact I love winter. Having lived all my life in California, I can't wait for it to be cold and dreary and depressing. And I'll be so happy.
In terms of movie work, what's coming up?
I just don't know. I have had so much on my plate. I haven't heard of anything and probably wouldn't even have time to read anything if it came my way.
But you continue to be a relentless campaigner for many really important causes, too.
Well, I think right now in my country, you better be a campaigner. You better get out there and try to change some of the things that are happening. Otherwise, I can't even think about it. We have to get more outraged. We have to run for office. We have to get elected. We have to change some of the things that are happening.
Might you run for office?
No. No, I'll be on stage. But I will certainly hope that I have the opportunity to campaign for people that should be in office, that should be making real important changes in the country and ultimately the world. They aren't happening right now, but Hopefully they will be.
And finally, Sally, will there be another book?
Gee, I don't know. I've always been writing. This is the first time I ever said, do it. So I don't know. There's a great quote by George Eliot that I would say all the time throughout my life, all the time. People, like children, would hear me say it and roll their eyes like, oh boy, here it goes again. And I realized the other day that it finally applies. And that is, she said, it's never too late to be what you might have been. And I think I am finally becoming what I might have been.
My thanks to Sally Field. Her memoir, In Pieces, is out now. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Sally will be starring in the Arthur Miller play, All My Sons, alongside Bill Pullman at the Old Vic Theatre in London from April the 15th, 2019. The Big Interview is produced by Yolene Goffin and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.